It's now my pleasure to introduce Penn State Vice Provost, Dr. Blanny Bowen.
Good afternoon. I'm pleased to introduce today's speaker, Dr. Lucia Rohr Murphy, who is also known as Dr. Murph. She's an expert on leadership development and team building, an executive coach, and a sought-after speaker. And she can answer some very puzzling questions such as, what do Cool Ranch Doritos teach us about leadership? Trust me, you'll see the connection in just about a minute. On the academic side, Dr. Murphy has taught management, marketing, and finance courses at Ursinus, St. Joseph University, the University of Arkansas, and here at Penn State. She's published in some of the top academic journals in the area of instructional systems. On the corporate side, Dr. Murphy has contributed to marketing strategy and human performance technology for Fortune 500 companies, including Xerox, Frito-Lay, and Campbell Soup. At Frito-Lay, she was a member of a team that developed Cool Ranch Doritos and Salsa Rio Tostitos. She wrote two case studies based upon Frito-Lay brands that were published in Marketing Strategies and by the Harvard Business School Press. As a senior product manager for the Campbell Soup Company, she wrote and presented a business plan for the national introduction of light-style entrees. Dr. Murphy received her Ph.D. in Instructional Systems from Penn State in 1999, and she completed part of her degree at Penn State Great Valley. Her doctoral research focused on the creation of learning environments, performance evaluation, and applications of marketing, systems and activity theories to performance. She also has an MBA in finance from Southern Methodist University and a bachelor's degree from University of Colorado at Boulder. Since 2002, she's offered numerous teleconferences, executive coaching, and motivational speaking through her business and website, and I love this, drmurphy.com. And she's the author of the new book, as Katie just mentioned, Leaders Speak, Seven Conversations That Create Sustainable Success. Dr. Murphy's faculty advisors here at Penn State remember her as insightful, enthusiastic, and a natural leader with a vision to set the world straight. Her topic today is Leaders Speak, debunking the myths that keep leaders playing small. I think I'm getting small all the time. Please give a warm welcome to a returning alumna, here, Dr. Murph, Dr. Lucia Rohr Murphy.
I was a little nervous before. Now I'm really nervous because all my cue cards are on the floor. Thank you very much. What I want to talk about today is about building legacy. And you guys are going to remember me as the speaker that talked about leadership from a PMS perspective. Powerful, memorable, and sustainable. PMS, you'll remember that. If I can work on it, somebody asked me to get a hot flash. So we'll work on that. I want to start, though, first by thanking you all very, very much for having me come out. Thanks to Joyce, Carol, you were fabulous, and the whole forum team. Thank you very much for bringing. You know how to make a girl feel welcome. And Andrew, I brought him up here with me. When I was in the program, this young man was 2 years old. I'm bringing with me a 12-year-old, and after last night in the soccer game, he's going to bleed blue, ladies and gentlemen. All right, the late Charles Schulz, who was the designer of the Peanuts cartoon, came up with a survey, and actually it had two questions, three parts each. He asked people to please talk about, if they could remember, the five last winners of the Heisman Trophy, the five last winners of Miss America, this is obviously not recent, right? And the five winners of the Academy Award Best Actor and Actress. People stumbled around. It was difficult to remember. Question number two, he asked people, what were the five teachers who most inspired you? The five people whose stories most impacted you? and the five friends who most helped you out. And guess what? People didn't have any problem whatsoever remembering. That's what leadership is. I'm going to talk about reframing the question so that we are talking about PMS, powerful, memorable, and sustainable. The foundation is courage, and the rest is up to you. So what we're going to talk about, we're going to talk a little bit about what leadership is, old models, new models, and emerging models. We're going to talk about how courageous leadership is a little bit different than perhaps some of the things that you're seeing and how it plays out in the world. And then we're going to talk about the five myths that keep leaders really playing small. In other words, all the excuses that we give ourselves for not taking the next step into what's possible for us. At the end of this presentation, I'm going to give you an opportunity to make a decision for yourself about whether that's a good alignment for you. All right, so does the world really need yet another leadership model? I mean, think about it. Well, maybe. A study that I just read this summer talked about the fact that a lot of the leadership models out there have not held up. Leaders tend to be inflexible. They're not able to react quickly, especially to the global market and the pace of business as it's changing. I would have a different perspective. I will tell you that the old models gave leaders permission to divert their eyes from what was really important, their people. It gave us permission to get really comfortable with being good enough. It gave us permission to get sort of okay, really full of ourselves. It really gave us permission to not ask the questions about what is possible. Interestingly, the Brookings Institute did a study about 7 months ago. They talked about 80% of the actual market value in most companies lives in their people. It's the non-tangible. It's the knowledge. It's the history. It's the branding. All of that stuff that you can't put on an asset, on a balance sheet. It's not a tangible asset. So what we've got going is, and this is really an impact of this kind of thinking for a very long time, we've got a real crisis of engagement. A series of Gallup polls have been conducted, and they found worldwide, across all different cultures, only about 21% of workers are engaged, interested in what they're doing. On the other hand, you've got 20% of the workers actively disengaged, disrupting what's going on in the workplace. Just that fact, that left productivity at the table, because when you have a worker that's not really contributing, they're leaving money on the table. There's an estimate in that Gallup poll, they estimated that the UK alone, they lost $64.8 billion in productivity. And in Japan, where engagement is only 9%, the estimate is $232 billion in lost productivity. So what's wrong? Perhaps our models are way too rational. I would argue that, in fact, that's where it falls apart. Leadership is not a science where you move one digit and everything else changes in a completely predictable path. So the old ways of thinking really started out with what they call the great man theory, and that is you, your core self, and the frameworks, how you think about who you are. Great man theory in this day of multicultural sensitivities, you can imagine how uncomfortable it is that if you don't check off this many things on the characteristics list, you're not a leader. Along came a different perspective, and they started talking about, okay, so what does a leader do? The action environments, where do they have an effect? You know, who are their workers? Let's measure that. Let's talk about the strategies that they set. People like Faulkner and Maxwell, they talk about what a leader does. That's okay. But what's starting to emerge is something that's really more courageous, and that is talking about what the combination of what a leader does and who a leader is. Now, I'm going to take it even one step further with what I call my leader speak model. And I talk about conversations. The word conversation means interweaving. So it's not just first who you are, and then we'll put that in a silo, and then what you do, and we'll put that in a silo, but really the weaving of that back and forth. It's a dance. It's a conversation. And the first conversation that you have is a conversation with context. And that is, what do you think your purpose is? Unless you believe that you're a product of a cosmic hiccup, there's some reason you're on this earth. What is it? Why are you here? And in what way are you to change history? Get an understanding of that. Then you take a look at you yourself, your gifts, your values, what you're all about. Next conversation is conversation with potential. And that's where we're going to spend a lot of the discussion today, because what we tend to do is dismiss that which is possible. Only after you have those conversations does it make sense to think about how you talk to others, your place within the organization and with the organization directly, with customers and potential customers and clients, and the community at large. And a key conversation that's missing in a lot of leadership is our impact on the well-being of the global planet. So those are pieces that are missing. Well, if this was so simple, why hasn't anybody found it sooner? The world was waiting for me, right? No, you know, seriously, stories. A gentleman by the name of Philip Slater said, man is unique among the animals, and that he absolutely knows that which is not true. Think about that. We're going to look at some of the stories that people have shared with me, and we're going to test them for reality. Now, I do a lot of work with individuals and leaders. I've literally spoken and worked with thousands of people, and whether they're domestic engineers or CEOs, you hear very similar things. So when I work with people, I try to help them do what's called learning in action learning. In other words, try to get in and learn while they're making mistakes, learn in a team environment, find some things out about themselves, about what's good and what's bad, and then test some of these stories. So what we're going to do, we're going to take the five top stories that people tell themselves about management and leadership, and let's take a look at them. I don't want conversation. Followed almost immediately with, damn it. You know where that comes from? When you were a kid. Close your ears, Andrew. When you were a kid, your mom said, I said so. I'm the mom. Don't ask me any more questions. Literally, I was working with a client, and they brought me on board because they couldn't understand how this brilliant person, this brilliant manager, was having all these amazing problems with her coworkers and her subordinates. I walked in and we started talking about it, and I just said, so, you know, what is it that, you know, this thing happened, so let's talk about what is your response? It's really easy. I'm the boss. I was sitting there going, ooh. Mom said so. See, if I focus on me and what you owe me, there's no bandwidth for you. And that's where it falls apart. See, when you start really making room for conversation, something amazing happens. Conversations are emergent. You can't pre-plan a conversation. So because it's emergent, it's more flexible. You have an opportunity, because it involves more than one person, to really increase clarity. You have an opportunity to become responsive if you're listening. That means you got to turn off the mom said so, because it's not getting in. Conversations work. Like I said, mentioned before, the word conversations means an interweaving. And honestly, we have conversations all the time. Sometimes they involve other people. Right? You know what I'm talking about. You cannot have sustainable success without conversations, period. And I put my reputation on it because I believe it. The only way to be truly engaged and be a powerful, memorable, sustainable leader, PMS, is to park it, ladies and gentlemen, and listen. Myth number two. Well, if I was so smart, I'd be rich already. I call this the lie of lack. Well, can't do anything about it. I don't have enough power. Need more credentials. Need more social status. Yada, yada, yada. Stop it already. What's interesting is this comes from our training where we believe we have to improve everything that's every possible little foible about us. We don't want to be human. We want to be superhuman. We want to be perfect. Newsflash, ain't going to happen. There's an interesting study conducted primarily by Marcus Buckingham, again, when he was working at the Gallup Institute. And he talks about, and they've shown it, I think it was something like 20,000 managers across the world. When a manager focuses on what's their strength and what's positive, they are powerful, memorable, and that's sustainable. Lie of lack. When we stop focusing on what we don't do well, you know what? I call it the paradox of easy. Not the button. Like Finlay's, what is it, the Staples some commercial? Paradox of easy. Well, if this was such an important thing, why would it be so easy? I can't believe somebody would pay me to do whatever. You know what? That's a key indication of what you need to be doing more of. Because there are people out there who can't do what you think is so easy. That's because it's built into your DNA. You know those little helicopter seed things? They're like oak seeds? You know what I'm talking about? Those little, I couldn't find any. We went out looking yesterday. I couldn't find any little helicopter seed things. Have you ever held one in your hand? You want to talk about? What is it like? It's soft. You could crush it. And yet in that seed, in the DNA of that seed, is the most powerful tree. Provides home for animals. It builds civilization in that DNA that you could crush in your hand. Why would you be any different? So what we need to ask is a little bit different, a different kind of question. We need to look at our genius. A genius is somebody who doesn't take themselves terribly seriously, Dr. Murph. It's somebody who does something really well, who is in touch with the possibilities that they understood as a kid. A mind once stretched by a new idea never regains its original shape. There's a reason for that. When you stretch, you expand, and that's good. So I invite you, instead of looking backwards, and I invite these leaders when I work with them, instead of looking backwards, benchmarking and whatever, and not to disrespect benchmarking, but it is a tool. It's not a philosophy. When you start trusting that you already have built into you what is possible, that then eliminates the lie of lack. In this school, this would be bad news. Leaders aren't taught, they're born. Okay, there's always going to be some issue. How much is, you know, born, how much is trained, that kind of thing. But when we talk about not being teachable, I would argue that maybe it's not classroom teachable per se. It's something that I would invite all of us, if you can, for example, a minute ago I was talking about not having to be perfect. If you can remove the need to be perfect, it's amazing what happens. Additionally, and just so that you know, and there was a leadership IQ study that was done in end of 2004. They found that the number one reason that CEOs lost their jobs was not because I suddenly got stupid. It wasn't competence. It was lack of focus. They forgot about their customers. They forgot about quality. They forgot about their products. Lack of focus. And we were talking about an interesting study that I also read, King's College at London University, done in conjunction with Hewlett-Packard. It was a test that involved 1,100 individuals, and they wanted to test the effect of this, they called it obsessive communication, you know, they're always having the BlackBerry on, the cell phone, and I was smiling to myself when somebody said, turn off your cell phone. Just so that you know, when the people did this, had this constant communication going, where they had to, the email, it dings, so you got to drop everything and check what's going on. You know, people in the study said, oh, it makes me so efficient. Within 2 hours, these individuals had the same effect as losing an entire night's sleep. Furthermore, the quality of their decisions dropped 10 IQ points. If you want to give me an advantage by keeping your cell phone on, knock yourself out, keep it on and lose those 10 IQ points, and then I've got you. Just as a point of reference, people who smoke pot lose 4 IQ points. That's not a call to action, by the way. Instead, if we take a look through the lenses of our values and gifts, because our values and gifts are what we are, who we are, and what we're all about. That then creates the dynamics of selective perception. Your brain doesn't know what's real, so it says, okay, this must be important. I'll set goals for that. I'll focus on that. And focusing on that then creates sustainable success, which comes back around and tells you who you are. Focusing on what you do well and what you stand for, that's really powerful, memorable, and sustainable. PMS. I love this one. And it usually goes something like this. It is so lonely at the top. If the most interesting conversation you're going to have all day is the one you had with yourself in the shower, no wonder you're alone. You gotta think it. And arrogance, there's nothing less appealing than arrogance. And a lot of leaders, bless their hearts, this is what happens. Lisa Marshall, in her book, in her study, actually found that one of the key crises that jumped a leader's ability to lead and maturity was the realization that they can't do it alone. No followers, hence no leader. Duh, right? What's interesting is when I work with individuals, your mind is like a magnet. It really is attractive. And what I mean by that is what you think about most triggers your mind about what's important. If you remember back to your high school chemistry class, and I had to look it up because I have no recollection of high school chemistry whatsoever, a magnet is a piece of iron. They should be the same. But if you look at a magnet under a microscope, literally, the molecules are lined up north to south. The more powerful a magnet is, it means that more of its molecules are lined up. And what's more is if you take a regular piece of steel and put it next to a powerful magnet long enough, it'll start rearranging itself to become magnetic. Your brain is the same thing. The words that you use, the way that you think, changes the things that the opportunities you see, the limits that you believe exist for you and your people, the potential that's possible in your team comes from the words that you use. William Shakespeare wrote, "A rose by any other name." I don't believe it. Because when you see this, do you see a rose or do you see the thorns? They're both there. Is this a collaborative meeting or is this a tryst? Are you in a highly competitive situation, or are you just stressed out? Do you work for somebody who's really funny, or is he a clown? The words that you use are not inconsequential. And if you want to have an incredible impact on your leadership, become very, very aware of the words that you use. Sounds easier than it is. It's very simple. It's just not easy. Okay? Kipling used to say that the words are the most powerful drug that man has available to him. And interestingly, I'll tell you just a real quick story. I'm a runner, and I will tell you that the day I decided, I was a jogger. Now think about that. Jogging is not a good thing. It jars your teeth. It's a rattling experience. And one day I woke up and I said, you know, from here on out, I'm a runner. I tell you true, my times dropped by 20% instantly. When I started I didn't do anything different. I just call myself something different. Roger Bannister, May 6, 1954. First, he did something they said was absolutely impossible. He ran a sub-4-minute mile. You know what? That record was bested 11 times after 9 years. What you believe the ceilings are real. They just don't have to be for you. Finally, myth number 5. Who wants to be living in a fishbowl? Newsflash, too late. People are already watching you. There was an interesting study that was reported, of all places, O Magazine this summer, where she was talking about people's perception about how much people notice them. You will almost always be off by 50%. You'd be surprised how much time people spend not thinking about you. However, we know from emotional intelligence that when a leader walks into the room, she or he can absolutely change the tenor, the energy in a room. And even more than emotional intelligence, the work of physicist and Dr. David Hawkins, he was able to prove at a cellular level how people, literally their molecules change in vibration when they're exposed to somebody who's grounded. They say that when Mother Teresa would walk into a room, it literally would get people calm. These things are not, they're not made up, they're fact. So if you know that people are watching you and you have that effect, then choose it to inspire greatness. Help other people get what they want. Do something so that you're modeling the kind of behavior that you want to see. Gandhi, become the change you want to see in the world. Always, always, always look for alternative explanations. There's got to be another way. Change your habits. Interestingly, in some of the Gallup studies about engaged workers, they only wanted 3 things. People to become engaged really just wanted to be valued, they wanted to be recognized, and they wanted somebody to know so they were cared about. The most powerful impact, the one place where those 3 things could be attained by employees fastest, was from their leadership. And in fact, there are some people that estimate that getting employees engaged is the number one way that leaders can affect the bottom line. So, if you choose to do courageous leadership, know that it's a question that you're going to have to keep asking yourself and a commitment that you're going to have to continue making all the time. And courage is very much like a muscle. You start with little things and you build up. We were talking earlier about lifting weights or running a marathon. You don't just decide and go. You build on it a little at a time. If you want to be powerful, you got to keep making decisions about helping others. Zig Ziglar 101. If you want to be memorable, Share your insights. Share something about you. You don't have to be perfect. You have to be human. If you want to create sustainability, then be a mentor. It's okay to fail. Thomas Edison is quoted as saying, failure? I don't have failure. I know 10,000 ways not to build a light bulb. Those are results. You've got to create the space to bring home your genius. Most of us are not afraid of our failure, truly. We're really afraid of who we could be. So as you sit today, and I want you to think about this, what is holding you back? These are the five myths that I've heard. But what is holding you back? Courageous leadership, it's not what you do. It's how and why you do it. It's not really the people you know. You know that thing about people you know and people who know that you know? Horse patootie. It's the people you connect with. That's what counts. It's not the knowledge that you have in your head, but how you're going to use it and for whose benefit are you going to leverage it. And finally, it's not the number of people who report to you. It's the number of people who you respect and who respect you. That is courageous leadership. So if you choose after today to do something about this and become a courageous leader speak person, don't worry so much about force. Connect with people. Don't worry about power so much as leverage or becoming reactive. Learn to be responsive, something that comes from within you. Worry less about teaching, you know, the open the head, outpour in the information, and instead model what you want people to learn. And you don't have to be manipulative if you're clear. In other words, I'm saying don't worry about being the best, worry about being your best. Afterwards, as I mentioned, I'm going to open it up to some questions, but I will invite you to stay around, talk for a little bit, meet my handsome son. And I have the book, Leader Speak. I have it, believe it or not, it's going to be in the bookstores starting 15th of October. So this is a sneak preview. And or drop me a note. And clearly, I'm a person who loves to talk. So drop me a note. I would love to speak with you. And so go for it. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
According to your website, your hallmark is courage, your signature is success, and your flavor is chocolate. Am I thinking too small if I put eat chocolate at the top of my to-do list so I know I'll get at least one thing done today?
You know what? You're not thinking too small. That's smart thinking. We all knew this, and I'm a longtime chocoholic. We all knew that chocolate was a healthy soul food. Now we just have the science to prove it. If you want to be a courageous leadership leader, you need to have a piece of chocolate every day. You didn't hear it here.
Isn't leadership more perceived than practiced? Meaning, don't the team members or masses define leadership?
Yes and no. Well, that's a definitive answer. and what I mean by that is, there are some people that are perceived to be better leaders by the team, but their ability to interact openly can shift the way the team works. So it's both. And that's why I talk about conversations, because it's not just one thing or the other. It's both. It's who the leader is as well as how the leader can share information to get people to work better together. So it's both. By the way, am I supposed to be behind this for bullet? No? Bulletproofing?
I think you're okay.
Okay.
What's your opinion about why there aren't more women CEOs among the Fortune 500 companies? About 3% of Fortune 500 companies' CEOs are women.
I have a lot of opinions about that, actually. And there are some real barriers real barriers. But I also know women, successful CEO women, and I've worked with successful CEO women, and I can tell you that first that glass ceiling exists in the space between our ears. And when a woman is, or a minority, by the way, anyone is able to step into that role, amazing things start happening. And people start moving up. It's a chicken and the egg kind of thing, because both things are there and both of them are real. But you're thinking about whether or not you're worthy, you can change. And I'll give you a real quick example. It's a little bit trite. But you know what's interesting is I work with, I volunteer on a lot of school boards, not a lot, but I volunteer on a school board, and I do a lot of works in schools with bullying. And it's an amazing thing that happens when a kid finally gets permission from his parents to take the other kid out. Do you know that they almost never have to take a swing? You know why? Because they show up differently. The kid that's been given permission to pop the other kid in the eye carries himself differently or herself differently, speaks differently, and so no one, it's almost like the bully is afraid to question that. So are there bullies out there that are keeping people of all race, gender, ethnic, whatever? Yes. However, you can shift it so you don't have to take a swing.
If you are the person on the other end of a conversation with the mom figure, how do you become a part of the conversation?
The other end of the conversation with a mom figure? Oh, like what I would do to Andrew. One of the things that I do, and this is useful, but you have to take this with a word of caution because it depends on how agitated your mom figure is. You need to say, wait a second, take a breath. I'm not threatening you. What would you like to do and what is this all about? And usually what happens when somebody gets to the stage, it's because it's got nothing to do with you. And in fact, remember this. When somebody really reacts negatively to you, it more than likely has nothing to do with you. It's an old script from before. So if you can get somebody, pause and take a breath. That's usually enough to get them grounded again. You can say, wait a second, I'm not threatening you. What is it that you need? You know, let's have an adult conversation.
This question is along those same lines, but maybe a little nuanced. How do you grow in your career when you're suppressed by a supervisor who is a micromanager in upper management?
Get yourself a new boss. That's a short answer. That's a flip answer. You continue to build your platform, your set of experiences, so that there comes a point where you can fish, and you know you got to decide fish or cut bait. You can just say, I'm out of here, and you take that package of amazing skills, including the fact that you've now become detail-oriented, the fact that you've now become incredibly tolerant to working with a jerk, right? You take that and you sell it to the highest bidder. And make it sound simple. It is really simple. When you stop getting anything out of it, it's time to move on. That's my thought.
This is a two-part question.
Okay.
How do you think your ideas on conversation might be translated into the political process, and who do you think are examples of political leaders who actually engage citizens in conversations?
There's a reason I made a list of some of my top leaders, and there's a reason I mostly went around to the history. it translates very importantly. It does translate very well into politics. I can tell you that a colleague of mine works with the Deputy Prime Minister of Canada. And when she's in a room with him and his staff, she sits there and she literally observes. And she goes to all the meetings. She's got all the security clearances. And she sits there and she listens. And then she pulls him aside and goes, is that really what you meant? how does that really line up with what you say is important to you? It can happen. It can happen. I think one of the easiest ways to get leaders of any type, political or otherwise, to really go there is to find somebody who's willing to be an angel on their shoulder. This woman is an executive coach, and she's trained in that, and she sits and does that for him and his staff. It's really difficult to do something and watch yourself do it at the same time. So if you can get somebody to be an observer, step back and watch you, whether you're in politics or anything else, that is a real powerful way to do that. And it can happen. I've seen it happen.
Who would you consider as the five best examples of leaders who fit your model in the current generation?
Current generation. Wow. I would say current generation or my generation? I'm trying to look for breath here. I would say probably Pope John Paul the Great, former Pope John Paul the Great. He was all about conversations. I would say, and he's a religious figure, and interestingly also is Mother Teresa. And I will tell you that I left my cheat sheet because I actually made a list. Current generation. Can I go? I'm gonna ignore the current generation thing, and I'm gonna go back. Chief Sitting Bull, unbelievable leader. Perhaps Eleanor Roosevelt. That's not my generation. I only look 22. She was an unbelievable. She was very much in a conversation, and she was very much a woman leader. Did I do five yet? And I'm really trying to stay away from the politics. Maybe Schwarzkopf, although he did do listening, it just wasn't necessarily evident in the front. If you read his Rudolph Giuliani. There you go. There's five. Oh, I gave you one extra. Rudolph Giuliani.
And a variation of that question, who has most inspired you?
I have to say, and I'm going to get all emotional, but that's okay. I would have to say my kids. Close your ears. It really brought me to a screeching halt when I would get questions about why things were the way they were, and you go, so I really became convinced that I, even just as one person, create a world where they wouldn't have to have the same constraints that I had. I'm a big fan of Eleanor Roosevelt. That which you fear the most, you must do first. There's a woman who grew up with people telling her she was stupid and ugly. She ended up doing amazing work. This may not be chocolate, but you can tell a woman is like a tea bag. You can only tell her strength by what happens when you put her in hot water. And she's got great sayings about what it's like to be a leadership position. And she had everything going against her, really. So those are a couple of them. I read a ton. I read all kinds of different things. And you'll see if you go through the footnotes in the book, there's everything from theater and whatnot. So, David Hawkins also, his work with the physics and molecular level physics. So.
How do you balance leadership and decision making?
Leadership is decision making. Leadership is about setting priorities based on values, and then decision making is an automatic thing that happens. A leader is not a leader that cannot make a decision, I would argue.
How are you measuring engagement?
There are actually very, and whoever asked the question, if you want to talk to me afterwards, there are standard definitions of engagement. It's about how excited I am about my work in the self-report, how excited I am about my work, do I feel valued, does my work have meaning, Does my leadership recognize me and acknowledge me? So I think the official survey that's been tested and retested is a page, but it's a really mouse print, lots and lots of questions. But there's a standard measure for that, for engagement. And again, it's people feel valued, people find meaning in their work, they like what they do, and they do it longer, they get more excited about it.
How important is personality in leadership, and can an introvert be an effective leader? If so, can you give an example?
Absolutely. One of the most amazing leaders that I know runs a Fortune, Fortune 100, right on the edge, maybe on the bubble of 100, maybe 102. But he is brilliant, he's handsome, he's dapper, and he would rather commit Harry Carey than give a speech. He is such an introvert. So what does he do? The things that he can, he delegates. He gives it to his people with personality styles that are, you know, counter to his, and that way it's about, you know, he's able to get that stuff done and directs in the background. Yes, lots of leaders are introverts, believe it or not.
Okay, this is a long one.
Okay.
A few years ago, companies and universities, including probably some within the room today, were made or encouraged to read the book Who Moved My Cheese in order to prepare for change. Can you suggest some ways that we might inform our supervisors and administrators that our ability to prepare for change is somewhat dependent on their need to change, that their own cheese has too many holes?
Wow, I like the metaphor. That works for me. The idea that your cheese has ever stopped moving, I find humorous. Cheese never stops moving, ladies and gentlemen. We got to find a different metaphor because that baby's shifting. What happens is we get comfortable, and that makes change difficult. However, like death and taxes, I mean, it's the only thing you can really be sure of. It's coming. What I have found is when people get centered and grounded in what they do well, then it's not something to be feared. So if your supervisor or your manager is really fearful of change, call me. I'll get it out of them. It's just about being grounded. They've got some other scripts going on, but change just happens. It's like where we live, we just say chocolate happens. Chocolate happens, change happens.
What advice do you have for a middle-aged person who's having trouble adapting to a technologically savvy world?
I hate technology. and it's funny, I was saying earlier that, you know, make sure you put your email address if you wanted me to get in touch with you, because, you know, the website's supposed to be ready, technology's not ready. It's ready whenever technology decides to be ready. How do you get ready for it? First off, you got to figure out what you can fight and what's worth your fight. A lot of times, technology is hoisted upon us like we have to do it. And the truth is, you'd be surprised how many comments I get when I just pick up the phone and call somebody. It shocks the bejeebers out of them. Or when I write a note. So we may do things for expediency. You can use that 10 points of IQ study. Throw that at your supervisor or your boss. Let them know that it's just making you stupid. And so if you can find non-technological ways to do the same thing, that actually would be to your advantage. And if you can, the things that you have to do, get as much information as you can. They can kill you, but they can't eat you. So if you can get some information about it and you can't get rid of it, then go for it. Just accept it.
Andy Grove of Intel doesn't believe in, quote, leadership. He thinks it's an MBA myth. What is your opinion of Andy Grove?
He's a myth.
We have time for
That's it. I'm not going there.
We have time for just one question, but first I'm going to join you on the podium.
Okay.
Faculty Staff Club and the Penn State Faculty Staff and the Penn State Bookstore, I'd like to present this plaque to you and our deepest thanks for a presentation that was nothing short of powerful, memorable, and sustainable.
PMS!
Who knew PMS could be so delightful? Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Wow. Thank you.
And we'd also like you to have this Penn State Forum mug as a souvenir of your visit here. Maybe Andrew will want to keep this to keep the Penn State name in front of him.
Thank you very much.
And the final question. Surveys have shown that for a majority of people, public speaking is their number one fear, followed by death as number two.
It really is true, yeah.
As someone whose career involves a great deal of public speaking, can you explain why the majority of people at, say, a funeral would rather be in the casket than delivering the eulogy?
It really is true. When we get up and speak, there's a chance that you're going to have something in your teeth. There's going to be a chance that you're going to stutter. I was telling before the presentation, I think it was it with you, Joyce? I was saying that I was once at a, my worst fear was to make a fool of myself. Well, I was one of the, I was giving a presentation in front of 350, 400 people, and they had a stage like this, and the locks underneath had gotten undone. And I walked up, and my heel caught in the thing, and I went flat on my face. You know what? Didn't kill me. Just thought I was going to die. I stood up and said, that's it. That's as much entertainment as they're going to get. Now let's talk about what the topic is. Unfortunately, the only way to get over speaking is to do it. And that's like a lot of things, ladies and gentlemen. That which you fear the most, you must do first. Even if it just starts with, and you know, it's like the childhood days when you had to get up and do recitation. You know, you choked, it was awful, awful. Your eyes twitched, your mouth got dry, your heart raced, you're going to get sick to your stomach. And then you had the teacher going, well, that wasn't exactly right, right? So we're looking for perfection. If you can start thinking of your public speaking, start with two people and have a conversation. And then have three people and have a conversation. And after a while, and it's not desensitization, but rather you learn that you really have a lot to add. And that, you know what, this is really fun. Okay, so maybe not fun, but it's not as bad as you thought it was going to be. A little bit at a time. And it's like anything. That which you fear the most, do first. And go for it a little bit at a time. I thank you so much for a wonderful audience.